Wyatt Cenac is a celebrated comedian. He won 3 Emmys and a WGA Award as a correspondent on The Daily Show. He was a writer for the hit animated show King of the Hill. He starred in the TBS ensemble alien abduction comedy series People of Earth. And his Netflix stand-up special, Wyatt Cenac Brooklyn, was nominated for a Grammy for Best Comedy Album. And now Wyatt has a late-night show with a conscience on HBO, Wyatt Cenac's Problem Areas. A documentary-style 30-minute program is Cenac's opportunity to deliberate on a range of issues, from lanes on sidewalks to chicken bones, yes, chicken bones, to homelessness, to gun control, to policing in America. Now, he conducts field reports and offers solutions-based conversations. Now, he's boldly trying to make a change. Now, the season finale for Wyatt Cenac's Problem Areas airs tomorrow night at 11:30 p.m. on HBO. Wyatt, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's pretty good stuff. Now, for people who have not seen it, how do you describe your show?
I try to describe it exactly like you did, but whenever I do, people usually tune out. So I've realized I have to do it a little bit shorter. And I'm not as poetic as you were with that description. So whenever I describe it, I typically say it's a topical show where we're trying to just look at social issues and look at them, you know, with an idea of what could be done, what can be done about things. And so with the whole season, we decided to look at policing in America and look at, you know, how do you take it from a very polarized national conversation and bring it to what it really is, which is a regional conversation. It's a more localized thing than people often talk about it with. And how do you do that and look at, are there things that could actually help to create relationships between law enforcement, community, legislators that work for everybody? Are there cities that are doing things that I wasn't aware of, that the audience wasn't aware of, that can speak to some of those issues that we've been talking about in that national conversation?
So who are you trying to target with this show? Because it's funny, but it's informative. And I saw it as news, but also commentary. You didn't lie, because there were a lot of facts in it.
Right.
And so I was drawn to that. But who is your target audience?
I guess anybody with an HBO Go account would be my main answer, since we're on HBO. I don't know if I have a specific audience in mind. I think for me, I've had the benefit of getting to tour as a comedian and going from city to city and talking to people, and you meet people, whether it's at a show or just going to a record shop or a restaurant or a bar, and people aren't as monolithic as we sometimes want to assume. And so it's interesting in meeting people and talking to them and just trying to understand the issues that people deal with. And so for me, I think in making a show, it was very much that same curiosity that I've had engaging with people after shows or in various cities. I wondered if I could take that to issues that I've been interested in or had questions about. And ultimately, would that curiosity be interesting to other people as well?
This season is devoted to policing, and I know you've had your own personal experience with interactions with police. I was surprised to learn that you were arrested for inciting a riot.
Yes.
How does that happen? Like, I just have this image of, like, you know, elephants and people running down the street, but it was much different than that. It wasn't that type of riot.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't a situation where I was like, you know, the dethroned king of Wakanda trying to reclaim his throne. I was in college and I worked at a mall. I worked at the Four Seasons Mall in Greensboro, North Carolina. And while I was at work, my car got broken into. And so I then tried to file a report with the mall cops. And in trying to file a report, they told me, one cop in particular came to my job and he said that they weren't going to file the report because it was my fault that my car had been broken into. And so I was like, how do you mean? And he said, well, you weren't in employee parking. And employee parking was a parking lot that was like three parking lots over. Mm-hmm. And everyone who worked at the mall parked in regular mall parking, because that's also where all the mall cops would hang out and try to scam on teenage girls.
So because you did the right thing, it's now your...
Yeah, it was my fault because, yeah, for this thing of like, yeah, you should have been in the scary super far parking lot where when you leave the job at 10 p.m. and you're walking by yourself to a super far dark parking lot that doesn't have lights, like, that's where you're supposed to be. And so I was kind of like, yeah, that seems weird, like my manager's parked there, like why is this, and you know, why is this my fault? And the cop continued to say it was my fault, and then he was at the same time kind of like, I'm real sorry about your car. And it was like, it doesn't seem like you're that sorry. And so ultimately the conversation got to a point where it felt like, okay, he doesn't have any sympathy for me, and just the fact that my car is broken into. And so I then was like, okay, he's not listening, he doesn't care, but my car is currently in regular parking, so let me go move it to employee parking, just to get away from this man. And so as I was walking away, he kind of shouted back at me like, real sorry about your car. And I at that point just kind of had lost my patience, and I turned around and I told him, I guess this is radio, so I told him to F off, but I said the whole word. And so then I started walking away, and the next thing I heard was him shouting my name. He grabbed me and cuffed me and then dragged me to a holding area that they had in the mall when they would arrest people, and said he was going to take me to the magistrate where I was going to be charged with inciting a riot. And he claimed that it was also illegal to say the F word in the state of North Carolina. Like, it was a lot of trumped up charges. And ultimately, my manager had to go to him and ask him to let me finish my shift. And capitalism won out in the day, where he let me go to finish out my shift. I still had the charge. I eventually had to get it expunged from my record. But in the in-between, I approached the mall cops and said, like, could you all just drop this charge? Like, it's now gone. You know, it's going to the magistrate. And they said no, but they offered to put me into a program called the First Time Offenders Program.
At the mall?
It would have been a statewide, like, okay. It would have been, I mean, this was all going on, like, my record. Like, this was, like, they were apparently cops that had authority in the state. So this was all going on, like, when I got it expunged, I had to get it expunged from, like, it was a police record. And so they were going to put me in a first-time offenders program. Again, the charge for inciting a riot. So anything I did, the way first-time offenders works, the first thing doesn't show up, but then let's say you get arrested for something else, both things show up and you get charged for both. So it's a, you know, in theory, the idea is you're a teenager, you got caught shoplifting, okay, we'll put you in first-time offenders program, and it's a little bit of, like, to help you walk the straight and narrow, like, this won't preclude you from, you know, getting a job or doing anything like that, but if you shoplift again, then you'll get arrested and it'll be double. You'll be charged not for one instance of shoplifting, you'll be charged for two. And so it was that type of, like, crime deterrent thing that he was putting me in for just saying F off after he wouldn't file a report that my car got broken into.
So it seems like the deck was sort of stacked against you. But just so that I'm clear, because I have this image of you as a teenager in this parking lot, walking away. Was there anybody else around you? Who were the rioters?
So I was still in the mall when this happened, because he came to my job to tell me that he wouldn't file a report. So when I was walking to the escalator to go up to go move my car, when he arrested me, part of the report said he was charging me with inciting a riot because I undermined his authority and other people could have heard it and chaos could have ensued.
Because of you.
Because I said F off, and that somehow the thought was like somebody at Wetzel's Pretzels could have heard that and said, oh, wow, look at that. Oh, well, these pretzels are free now, and that the whole mall could have caught fire. And yeah, I'm banned from that mall.
Are you really?
Yeah, because once, like, I got everything expunged, but then I think after, like, going to the cops and trying to, like, ask them about, like, why this was a charge and why this is going on my record as, you know, I'm, like, a sophomore in college, like, why this is all happening, they got annoyed with me asking them questions. So then they filed a report claiming that I harassed them. And so as a result, I got banned from that mall, and I've not set foot in the Four Seasons Mall since.
It's funny in the one sense, but on paper, you look pretty bad. You know what I mean? I'm meeting you in person, but that's the heart of what you're discussing, because on paper, people look pretty bad, and yeah. You have these compound consequences.
Yeah, and you're talking about a 19-year-old who, you know, a situation where a 19-year-old whose car got broken into, like, the thing that you want in that moment is somebody to at least help you understand, like, okay, your car got broken into. That's terrible. And it would be terrible if any customer's car got broken into. My car was right next to any customer's car. And so to, one, make a distinction that somehow your car, even though there's nothing on my car that says this guy works at Champ Sporting Goods, like, to somehow say that because I work in a mall, my car is somehow different than somebody else's, and is, you know, and not to, you hope that in a situation like that, law enforcement would be sensitive and say, okay, look, the truth of the matter is, if anything got stolen, we're probably not going to be able to retrieve it in most of these instances, but let's get you a report. The thing you should do is file your insurance, and, you know, in situations like this, like, if you feel weird or anything like that, like, let us know where your car is, assuming, like, your locks, you know, one of my locks got popped off, the glass was broken. Like, you would hope that they would at least help to, you know, allay any fears or concerns you had in that moment, as opposed to simply taking this weird aggressive stance and then to take it then to a place of, right, this person who just had their car broken into, now I'm going to turn them into a criminal and put these things on their record that, yeah, could
make things worse much later on.
Yeah.
And I get this speaks to the core of what you think is wrong with policing in America. We're going to take a brief break.
Sure.
And when we come back, I want to discuss how you spend 10 episodes of this comedy documentary-style show exploring this. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with comedian Wyatt Cenac about his new HBO show, Problem Areas. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. And welcome back. I am talking to Wyatt Cenac about his new HBO show, Problem Areas. So, Wyatt, 10 episodes where you explore policing in America, and you do it in the sort of dry humor. I was struck by this British voice that comes out of nowhere. Why did you choose this British voice? These reports. What is this?
We chose that because I think a little bit of it was a nod to one of our executive producers on the show, John Oliver, who is British, and he uses an American voice to do some voiceover stuff for his show. So it felt like, okay, as a nice nod back, we'll use a British voice.
It made me think about those documentaries, like Natural Geographic.
Oh, where, like, the Edinburgh ones and stuff, yeah.
Like the animals in the wild in America. Look at this strange culture. I was like, what is this?
Right, yeah. Well, and to some degree, I think, you know, you find yourself in places and states, or even just talking about ideas that may not always, they seem foreign. And some of them are ideas that are things that are, that you learn about are like, oh, that's something that people do two states over or something. Mm-hmm. So it does feel at times like this country as much as it's like, oh, I think I know a lot about this country, you go places and you see things that are like, oh, that's totally foreign to me. Mm.
In the first episode, you discussed the wrongful murder of Philando Castile in St. Paul, Minnesota. Now, community leaders talk about the need to, quote, improve police training to fix the system. But in St. Paul, apparently, they're focusing energy on what they are describing as character-based hiring. What exactly is character-based hiring?
So my understanding of character-based hiring is that they are trying a process where they're looking beyond simple test scores and the sort of basic things that might typically rule officers out or potential officers out, things like credit score. And 'cause for a lot of, I guess, departments, if you have a bad credit score, they won't even accept you to the police academy. And so they then have tried to spend their time digging a little deeper and saying, well, let's figure out why this person has a bad credit score. Is it because they, you know, just got a bunch of credit cards and decided to go buy a bunch of stuff? Or is it that they took on, a loan to help a family member or something like that? Or is it, you know, something of whether it's like student loan debt or things like that? But trying to understand and open up the pool of potential candidates for police work, looking at that as like, right, what is the character of that person? Because maybe that says more about somebody than simply going off of, well, this person has a good credit score, that makes them trustworthy.
And in this way, when you say open up the candidate pool, you're talking about creating more diversity, more people of color on the police force and women?
It seems like from talking to Sheriff Sarir, who was the sheriff of the Ramsey County Police Department, that our sheriff's department that we spoke to, that's part of their hope, is to open up the pool and diversify the pool of people in who are taking those jobs, whether it's sheriffs in the sheriff's department or corrections. But yeah, trying to diversify the types of cadets they have, both from life experience and as well as, demographics.
Watching your show, I learned that the sheriff actually conducted focus groups to identify the characteristics that the public expects of their police force, which I thought was pretty innovative. So what were the qualities that were most valued?
So for them, it's weird because they would kind of speak about four major characteristics, which were, you know, like honor and respect and trustworthiness. And so those things sound kind of broad, like trustworthiness. Okay. Like that's, you know, what does that mean? But their approach to it, it felt like was one, trying to keep reminding officers that their role and responsibility is to serve the people of the community that they've sworn to protect and to actually serve them. And I think something that happened recently there, and it was sort of, it was a little bit about what our episode touched on, is the officer who killed Philando Castile, he had taken some secondary training that was what's considered warrior training. And
Warrior training.
And it was, I think its initial purpose was for military, but it's found its way into police training throughout the country. And there's one trainer in particular who teaches something that he calls killology. And the idea is to try to condition, whether it's military or police, to become okay with the idea of killing.
I want to make sure I heard you right. You said killology.
Killology. And so this officer who killed Philando Castile, he had taken this killology, a two-day killology workshop. And that was a part of that story. And what's been interesting recently in the St. Paul area, Falcon Heights, which was the community where Philando Castile, That's where he was killed in Falcon Heights. So that police department, the St. Anthony Police Department, that the police officer who killed Philando Castile was a part of, they're no longer the police department of Falcon Heights. The Ramsey County Sheriff's Department has taken over. And recently it was some sheriff's deputies were supposed to take some warrior training and the sheriff pulled the deputies out, and there was outcry from the community, and it felt like, oh, this seems like a moment where community and law enforcement may be more engaged in conversation. I don't know specifically how those conversations went or if they were having direct conversations, but at least in one report after the sheriff pulled the deputies out, he seemed to say in an interview that he didn't feel that it would be the best thing for the community, that he felt like it would be seen as insensitive and that it would be insensitive, and that he needed to sort of take their, you know, take their needs into account. And there was something about that that felt refreshing, that if that is the case, that the sheriff and the sheriff's deputies are willing to listen to the community, the same people who through their tax dollars are paying for this service, that if they are saying, we don't want our officers to be trained to be warriors, we want them to be people who see their community as, you know, collaborators, as people, and not as targets, you have to have some hope that there is, you know, that something like that, that type of communication could be replicable, and that it doesn't have to be unique.
You explore this through this mix of, you know, almost journalism, documentary, filmmaking, and also comedy. Why do you think that particular mix is important for this type of story to get out there?
I think for me, I have always come at everything with comedy in mind. I'm a comedian, and so my credentials as a journalist are fairly thin. But my background coming from a place like The Daily Show, we at that show realized, you know, and long before I got there, but comedy and satire was a way to talk about issues and talk about them in a different way, and in a way that is hopefully entertaining to people, but also in a way that allows us to approach it a little differently. Mm. And so that's something that I think, you know, you can, throughout the history of comedy, whether you're talking about, you know, whether it was Richard Pryor or Pat Paulson, or even going back to like Mark Twain, like there has always been this element of using comedy to look at and, you know, look at the world in different ways. And so for me, that was always front and center with doing something like this, but also having worked at a place like The Daily Show and worked in television in that way, that's always been something that I've wanted to do and to continue to do. And so to get to do it in my own show for HBO has been, you know, that's been a goal for a long time.
It really is fascinating because you discuss a lot of different topics on your show. This season, you covered space travel, automation, the sanctuary restaurant movement, student loan debt and banking deserts, among a whole lot of other things. How do you choose the topics for your show?
A lot of that goes, you know, a lot of credit there goes to our writing staff, our producers, our researchers. We wind up chatting a lot about things that interest us, things that are perhaps conversation pieces that, you know, with something like student loan debt, that's one of those things that for us it was interesting to talk about it because we were seeing that it has been talked about as an impending financial crisis, that, you know, it's that there are, I guess, so many people who are pretty close to defaulting on their student loans.
It's sort of extraordinary. Apparently, in the next 5 years, nearly 40% of people who entered college in 2003 are expected to default on their student loans.
Right.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. And it says something when, you know, we're talking about something like that, and we're talking about, you know, how if that bubble bursts, you're also talking about it in a place where people are going to college with the hope of getting a job and with the, you know, with the, and college, that has always been the promise that you go to college, you're guaranteed to get a job with a college degree. You're guaranteed to be set up for life better with a college degree. And now what we're saying is, oh, that might not be the case. Or even if it is the case, chances are you're going to be in debt to a degree that it will impact and affect your life for decades to come and affect your ability to get a house, to, you know, to do so many things. And so seeing that that's one of those things that is a social issue that we, you know, that is on the horizon, it raised so many questions for us in the room, in the writer's room, talking about it and thinking about, you know, what does that mean? And what does it mean when you also look at colleges now where you see these colleges that, whether it's, you know, colleges with these huge endowments or colleges that are spending their money on things like lazy rivers and rock climbing walls, are they as committed to that promise that we have been sold for, you know, decades?
Are you suggesting vocational school?
Vocational school, I think for a lot of people, there is an argument for vocational school, and I think this country, for whatever reason, we have given vocational school a bad rep. But vocational schools, if you look outside the United States, vocational schools are celebrated in many other countries, and they provide great opportunities. I mean, it's weird when you go, you go on an Etsy shop and you see so many people who probably have NYU degrees that are, you know, doing woodworking or, you know, like, you know, making metal sculptures. And it's like, you might have been able to save yourself some money and just gone to vocational school, learn how to weld. And then, yeah, on your weekends, you could have made, you know, metal sculptures, and you probably would have come out of that vocational school with a job already, and you wouldn't have the debt that you have.
I have 45 seconds left, but do I understand it correctly that instead of paying off student loans, you bought a sailboat?
It's more of a dinghy. It's less a sailboat, more a dinghy.
More of a dinghy. Well, thank you very much. Your show is amazing. I'm really looking forward to seeing tonight's episode. I've been speaking with comedian.
Tomorrow night's episode. Friday's episode.
That's the secret. Okay. I've been speaking with comedian Wyatt Cenac about the new HBO show Problem Areas. Thank you again. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break.